nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Any questions before we get started? Anything that you've been looking at doesn't make sense? Are you all following along okay? Are you all finding that when you need to refer to the Williams and Carter textbook, it's obvious where we are, right? Right? I mean, you have that information kind of falling out pretty readily from this, I hope. Right? Is anyone doing that, or is everyone just relying on my notes? Yeah? Okay. And it's pretty easy to do, right? You can find the areas that we're talking about. I have it divided more or less the same way, right? So, okay. So the thing we're going to do now is move on to talking about the Lowy equations and the reciprocal lattice construction. And this is the way that we really generally understand diffraction and think about diffraction in the electron microscope. So again, what we want to do is we want to go through and kind of go a step further. We're going to take and first formulate our Lowy equations, describe those particular equations and get to the details of that. And then from that, we will discuss how to form what's called the reciprocal lattice and motivate that. I mean, it's not something we're doing arbitrarily. The reason we do it is because if we have a reciprocal lattice construction and know that diffraction follows the Lowy equations, we can show that we have another way to state Bragg's law that ends up in a very simple geometrical construction embodied by what's called the Ewald sphere. And then we'll finish off talking about how you can have deviations from exact Bragg reflections still show up on the Ewald sphere, and how this really leads to the diffraction patterns that we see in the microscope. Okay, now we are going to say that in the past, right, when we talked about diffraction, we said let's consider the reflection of electrons or X-rays off of planes. But we commented that those planes are not real. We're instead specifically only considering how electrons come in and have coherent elastic scatter off of the atoms that are present in the sample. And so what we want to do is generalize more thoroughly by saying, let's consider an incident wave in that's seeing two atoms that are spaced apart in three dimensions with respect to some reference axes in the following way. And what we want to ask ourselves is, when do we see constructive interference? The same questions that we've asked with respect to Bragg's law. And so if we look in just one direction, if we take this situation and planarize it onto just one of the three axes we're considering, we would find that we would have constructive interference when the difference in path length on the bottom part of this wave minus the difference in front of the scattering event on that wave is again equal to some integer times the wavelength, right? Because again, we'll end up having constructive interference because we have an integral number of wavelengths that this bottom vector has traveled with respect to the top one, okay? So the idea is, again, very similar to what we were doing when we were describing Bragg's law. The thing can be done in all three normalizations, right? You can do this for arbitrary axes A, B, C, or X, Y, Z, whatever you want to call them. And then you end up with three particular equations that then capture the same idea normalized onto three planes, okay? So the idea is that we now have the ability to look at this between any two atoms and see that if we have a wave come in and scatter off of these two atoms, we're going to see constructive interference in the far field when we again have these equations met, saying that the path length difference is equal to an integral number of path lengths. Okay? So again, when doing this, you're going to find that a lot of these things look neat and tidy, and that's because what we're going to do now is start to talk about these not as different numbers of n, but we're going to refer to them as HKs and Ls because, as you know, that's where we're going to go in describing plane descriptions is with HKLs and the like. Okay, so that should clue you into to where this derivation is going to go. But again, just a simple idea. Wave comes in, if it scatters, if it has an integral number of wavelengths, difference as it meets in the far field, you're going to see that you have a constructive interference. And again, if you choose a different angle to look, that may or may not be met. So we're only going to see constructive interference at particular angles the same way that we would see them with the Bragg diffraction equation, right? So the same idea is embodied in this, all right? Now, here's where we're going to go a step further on this. Let's go through and define the incident wave and the diffracted wave or scattered wave by considering their wave number. And in this case, we're going to consider their wave numbers, k incident and k diffracted, to be unit vectors and have a modulus that's a length of 1 over lambda, okay? So that's just going to be the definition of how we're going to define k sub I and k sub d in this case. And it's a reasonable definition because it's just a matter of what you describe, you know, decide as your unit, unit lengths. So what we'll do now is do this instead of going and doing it with respect to these angles gamma 1 and delta 1 and the like, we're going to instead try to do this vectorially because, again, it allows us to simplify things and understand things a bit more clearly. So in this case, right, what we want to do is find out that if we have, this is the length traveled here, the length traveled there, and so again we have r dot the difference between the diffracted minus the incident, and that's going to give us, again, a equation that has a resulting coherent scatter in the far field whenever this is equal to some integer. All right. Now what we're going to do is take this generalized equation, which again, just note that's that capital kappa that we've defined earlier as being the difference between the scattered wave and the incident wave. And we're going to resolve this onto particular directions, the unit lattice vectors of A, B, and C. So in real space, we have described our atom positions with respect to an origin. And on that origin, we place, you know, unit axes of A, B, and C. And so what we can do is take this general equation and resolve it onto the unit axes of A, B, and C. And again, we're going to find that we have coherent scatter when we have these things being integer values. And again, we'll choose to call these integer values h, k, and l. All right. So again, go through and follow through this. You'll find, again, that this is equal to a distance difference, right? And this has to be an integral number in order to have a coherent scattering event. And so again, we can take this generalized equation and resolve it onto the specific lattice vectors that are present, a, b, and c. And we'll find that we, again, get coherent scatter when these things are equal to integers. And we're just going to call these h, k, and l, okay? So it's, again, just a methodology for pulling all this together. So the definition of diffraction, then, and when we see coherent diffraction in the far field, is whenever we have these equations met, whenever we have this capital K, which was, again, equal to the difference between the incident wave vector and the diffracted wave vector, dotted with all three of these unit axes equaling integers, that's when we're going to see that we have diffraction occurring. And so what the Lowy equations have done that is an improvement on the Bragg equations is they've now gone through and allowed us to have a formal vectorial description of when we are going to see diffraction occur, when we're going to see that the incident wave and the diffracted wave sum coherently in constructively in the far field and give us a diffraction event, okay? And the thing that's nice about this is that it no longer considers anything associated with this mythical idea of a plane, but what it now does is it captures the ideas of where atoms are, and we'll go through it and find an even more simple way to look at that. But it's one that's strictly valid, and it allows us to have a three-dimensional array of atoms to look at to consider this. Okay, so that's what leads to this being a more correct description. All right, so we have a question from John.
Yeah, HK and L, that's just completely random. It's not related to Miller indices.
Well, so it will be. Okay, so that's where we're going to go. Okay, so as I say, it's not coincidental we're using HK and L, but they must be integers. So the question was, right, you know, are those Miller indices? Well, what we're going to find out is yes. But we're, for now, saying that just arbitrarily, they're integer numbers of h, k, and l, okay? And so what we're going to do next is we're going to go through and find a way to relate those to real space Miller indices of planes, h, k's, and l's, all right? So that's where it leads to. But again, this is just a way of saying that if we look at, you know, positions of two atoms in space, how do we take an incident wave in and see a scattered wave out, right? And so how do we go through and formalize that using a vectorial description? And again, just to simplify, we use this capital K, which is equal to the difference between the incident wave vector and the scattered wave vector. And we're going to take a dot product with it and all three of the different unit lattice vectors, A, B, and C. And whenever we have those dot products equal to integers, arbitrary integers, then we're going to go ahead and have a diffracted event occur. Okay? Okay. So there's going to be some funkiness in terms of how we go through all this in the next series of steps, but the reason to do it is, again, to have a nice, simple way of showing all this geometrically. Now, this is the first time you kind of hear this whole concept. It seems like somewhat of a strange thing to do. But what we're going to do next is we're going to go through and say, look, if you have a lattice in real space that has unit vectors of A, B, and C, right, that are capturing the unit cell information, you can, if you would like, establish another lattice that has a relationship to that, okay? And that relationship is one that's called the reciprocal lattice. You'll find out why it's called that. But what we're going to do is just arbitrarily say that for a unit cell that has lattice vectors A, B, and C, we have the option of constructing a new lattice that's based on that, that has particular characteristics, okay? And the reason to do this is because if we go through and do all this, at the end you're going to find out that this reciprocal lattice leads to a very visual way of seeing diffraction. So what we're going to do is we're going to say, hey, we have said that diffraction occurs whenever this difference between the incident wave vector and the diffracted wave vector is dot product with real lattice vectors A, B, and C and yielding integer values. This can also be solved. We can also have this occur whenever we define the capital K vector as a lattice vector that has integer values of H, integer values of K, integer values of L, in front of a new set of unit cell vectors. And these new unit cell vectors, which we're going to call A star, B star, and C star, have particular interrelationships to the real unit cell, A, B, and C. Okay, so this is the definition of how we're going to define our reciprocal lattice, this new arbitrary lattice. But if we look at this definition, it says that A star dot A equals 1, B star dot A equals 0, C star dot A equals 0, A star dot B equals 0, and it follows along through here in all of these 9 terms. What this yields, if you look, right, is it says, look, if I take the first term, H, and I multiply it, and I have A star, right, and then I take the dot product of A star with A, what do I get? 1, right? So I have H, which means I've solved the top of these 3 Lowy equations, okay? Same with B, right? K times B star, dot product with B is going to give me the value of K, an integer value, so we again have the solution to the Lowy equations. C star, same thing, okay? C star dot C equals 1, and so the bottom Lowy equation is also satisfied. Whenever we create a vector that has this form, an integer in front of A star plus an integer in front of B star and an integer in front of C star, okay? And A star and B star and C star are related to the real lattice vectors A, B, and C in the following way, okay? So this is just an arbitrary thing to be doing at the moment, but we're going to follow how this all works through. This thing here, the A star, B star, and C star, is thus a new description of the initial lattice that we had, but it's a description that has different characteristics that are embodied by these dot products that are listed here. And so what we're going to call this one here, A star, B star, and C star, is that we're going to call this the reciprocal lattice of the real lattice, and you'll see why reciprocal is the term used. But what it means is that anytime we have a unit cell in real space, there is an equivalent description of that same unit cell in something called reciprocal lattice space, and it's that that's defined by these vectors here. Okay? That seems weird, and it seems arbitrary. But it follows, let's just keep moving on, okay? And you'll get comfortable with this in time, and you'll start to think about things in reciprocal space, which is an odd thing to be doing, okay? Okay. So, this new lattice that we've defined, where we have some vector in real space, right, that has some arbitrary length in A, arbitrary length in B, arbitrary length in C, is related to a reciprocal space vector in the following way, where again, the properties of that lattice are as described on the previous page, A star dot A equals 1, A star dot B equals 0, A star dot C equals 0, and onward. And so you can take any vector in real space and create an equivalent reciprocal lattice vector reciprocal space vector that has the properties as described below. Now, the point here is that this is general. You can talk about the position of a point with respect to the origin in real space, and then define an equivalent vectorial representation in reciprocal space. That does not have to be an integer generally, but what we're going to find is whenever these values are integer values, when m1, m2, and m3 equal integer values, then we're going to have a situation where the diffraction equations are met. Okay, so that's the reason that this is used. It's worth noting that there are several properties of this reciprocal lattice. We're going to take advantage of these as we go through and show a derivation or two later. But basically, whenever you have a real lattice defined by vector A, vector B, and vector C, the reciprocal lattice vectors have the following properties. A star is going to be equal to the inner product of B and C divided by the overall volume of the unit cell. This implies that A star is perpendicular to B and C, both. Same with B star and C star. And so these are, again, some geometric results of the description of the reciprocal lattice we set forward. Okay? And we're going to use those geometrical results to go through and derive some things in a moment. Okay? Now, another thing to remember is that this is not something that is indicative or constrained to situations where our real lattice has orthogonal unit vectors, right? So if you have a square, right, then A and B and C are orthogonal to each other, right? But if you have a trigonal unit cell, right, that's just one that has, you know, alpha and beta and gamma all not equal to 90, then your reciprocal lattice will follow all of these properties as described. But again, A star, B star, and C star will not have the same angular relationships between them because of the way that this is all put together. So that's just a bit of caution there, okay? Okay, so this is where this starts to at least build into something, I think, coherent or reasonable to be doing. What we're going to do is we are going to explore the properties of a well-chosen vector in reciprocal space, okay? So I'm going to just call a vector, we'll pick the name G, because everybody in electron microscopy does, okay? And we're going to look at the properties of a vector G that is composed of a unit, that's composed of an integer value in front of A star, an integer value in front of B star, and an integer value in front of C star. In other words, let's consider a particular vector in this newly created reciprocal lattice and ask ourselves a couple of things about that if these values of h, k, and l are integer values. Okay? So what we're going to find is that there's an interrelationship between h, k, and l if they are all integers. That says are both integers. That should, of course, say all integers. Sorry. Where h, k, and l are all integers. And what we're going to find out is that there's interrelationships between some interesting things going on with this new vector g and a plane in real space described by the Miller indices h, k, and l. Okay, so this returns to John's question earlier. John said, are these h, k's, and l's the Miller indices in real space? And the answer is they can be, and the times that they are is when we see diffraction, and that's where it's going to go. Okay? Okay, so let's consider this vector I've just decided to start looking at, calling it G, saying it's one that has an integer value in front of A star, an integer value in front of B star, an integer value in front of C star, where H, K, and L are all integers. And let's consider what happens if those H, K's, and L's are related to a specific plane in real space. Okay? What we're going to find out is that this vector G has two properties that are going to be very, very important to us. Namely, it is perpendicular to the real space plane, and it has a length which is equal to reciprocal of the d-spacing, 1 over the d-spacing. Okay? So these things are things we're going to use to, again, visualize diffraction, and we'll prove them in the next couple slides, But if we have chosen this vector with these constraints, that h, k, and l are integers, then these properties are in fact true. The vector g is perpendicular to the real plane h, k, l, and the vector g has a length that's equal to 1 over the d spacing of the h, k, l planes in real space. Okay? And again, this 1 over is the origin of why we're calling this the reciprocal lattice, okay? Because it has a reciprocal relationship with d spacings. Okay. So you can accept these on faith. You can also just go through and show the derivations. I'll show the derivations because I think they just help you gain some confidence that I know what I'm talking about. Let's just do them quickly. If you find that you don't quite see this immediately, go home, look at it, you will. It's pretty straightforward. Let's go through and prove these, okay? Let's draw a plane, okay, in real space, right? Here I'm showing x, y, and z, and these are, of course, along the same directions as our unit vectors a, b, and c, okay? Let's draw a plane and define it by the Miller indices h, k, l. That, of course, by definition, has these interrelationships with a, the vector, unit vector a over h, the unit vector b over k, and the unit vector c over l. That's the definition of a Miller indice for a plane. Okay? That's how we go through and describe the Miller indice of a plane. Okay. Step one, let's consider a vector that goes from the origin out to this point A. That vector is going to equal A over H, the vector A over little a over H. Let's consider another one, the vector AB, right? And that's then going to equal, it looks like it'll go and be the vector B over K, right? That's just simple vector calculus, okay? Vector addition even. So let's go through and do that, right? So that's this one plus that one equals that one. We'll rearrange. So now this vector AB, which is in the plane HKL, right, is equal to the difference between B over K minus A over H. That's an important point, right? AB is necessarily in the plane HKL. Okay. So the question is if we take and have our definition of this new vector G, is it perpendicular to this direction AB? So we can go through and do a dot product. We'll take in HA star plus KB star plus LC star and dot product with this new description of AB, which is B over K minus A over H. And you use the fact that the definitions of A star, B star, and C star are as follows. And you'll find that, okay, do the dot product. Let's commute the HA star with this one, that's 0, minus that one, that's minus 1. Let's commute the B star, that's 1, minus 0. The C stars, right, 0 with all of them. And what do you find? 1 minus 1 is 0. Okay? Okay. So what we've just done is shown that this special chosen vector G is perpendicular to AB. You can do the same thing to show that it's perpendicular to AC. Go home and do that, right? But it should follow. All we're going to use is a different set of these things. We're going to use A over H, AC, and C over L. And you're going to find the same thing. And so what this means is it means that G, our specially chosen vector, is necessarily perpendicular to the plane in real space, HKL. Yes? It works in everything. Okay? I'm showing it. I can't draw a trigonal. I'm not that bright. Okay? But it works in everything because of the definitions that are used here. A star dot A equals 1. B star dot B equals 1. Right? There's nothing here in any of this little simple derivation I did that requires A to be perpendicular to B, to be perpendicular to C. All it requires is for us to have this lattice, A star, B star, and C star, defined in this way. Okay? Great question. So Lior asked, right, is this true for trigonal or others? And the answer is yes. It's true for every system as you define a reciprocal lattice in the following way. Okay. So that's pretty handy, right? It's kind of interesting, right? So we've gone through and done this odd thing. We've gone from a real space description describing our unit cells with A, B, and C to this arbitrary A star, B star, C star. And what we've recovered from that already is something that's pretty interesting. If we take a vector that has integer values in front of A star, B star, and C star, we find out that that thing is perpendicular to the real plane HKL. Okay, that's interesting. Whoever thought of this, pretty smart, all right? Been able to think in a very abstract way, believe me. Okay, all right. The other one that I said was true was that this vector G has a length equal to 1 over the real space between the planes HK and L. Okay? That's called D sub HKL. Okay, so here's again just the derivation of that, right? The shortest distance must be a projection of a real lattice vector onto a unit vector in the direction of G. Okay? So G is perpendicular to HKL. We know that, right? So the shortest distance must be a projection onto that. So this is just one way of doing that. Let's take this distance from the origin to a point on the plane n, okay? And you can go through and show that if that is a vector n, little n, and you dot product it with one of these projections, A over H, right? You get A over H with G over G because it's a normal, right? It's that's the definition of the normal vector there. And so again, this one on the second line here where we have DHKL equal A over H dotted with, now the full description of G, HA star plus KB star plus LC star, again, this will only be equal to 1 here. This term's going to go to 0, that term's going to go to 0, and you recover the fact that DHKL is equal to 1 over the length of G, and you flip that the other way. And again, based on how we've described and defined the reciprocal lattice, and our choice of a special vector G, we've recovered an additional interesting thing, that this special vector G has a length that's equal to 1 over the spacing of the real planes. Okay? Okay. Again, seems arbitrary, but these things should please you. They feel like they're giving you some good descriptions, right? So the question we're going to ask ourselves is how do we use that later? Before we do that, I want to look at this reciprocal lattice and think about what it implies. What this means is it means that if we take some real space lattice, such as the one shown on the upper right, right? In this case, again, I've drawn it orthogonal because that's the only way I'm able to do this. I'm not smart enough to do it in a trigonal system, okay? So I've drawn this in an orthogonal system, but I've chosen one that's not square, okay? But again, this is a unit cell in real space. These are real planes, you know, HKLs in real space. If we have this special vector G, then it connects in reciprocal space points on the origin to specific points in reciprocal space that are, one, perpendicular to the real space planes and of a distance, right, equal to 1 over the d spacing. Okay? So if we take a real space picture of planes, it yields a reciprocal space picture of points where the distance from the origin to each of these points is equal to 1 over the d spacing of the real planes, and it's perpendicular to the real planes themselves. Now, the fact that we've gone through and taken a series of planes in real space and ended up with points in reciprocal space, again, gives you a clue as to why this is useful, okay, or where we're going to go with this. When you look at a diffraction pattern, you see points, right? And those points arise from, by Bragg's law at least, scatter from planes, okay? And so what we're going to find is that this description allows us to relate the real planes that exist in our unit cell and in our material generally to points in a reciprocal space. And then we're going to find out that there's a way to choose those points so that we see diffraction come out of all of this, okay? So, again, this motion from a real space to a reciprocal space, not really that arbitrary. It's actually just really, really intelligent, okay? Okay. Again, just a final point to emphasize what Lior had asked me. If you do this, this is true for any type of unit cell. I'm only capable of drawing these things in orthogonals. I did work very hard to at least do something that's moderately accurate on something that's trigonal-ish, okay? And again, the definitions between real and reciprocal mean that if you do not have orthogonal unit cells, you again have a non-orthogonal reciprocal space. Okay, just to emphasize this, I want this in your notes so that at a later date you don't make this mistake, because it's easy to make this mistake if you work on something other than cubic or orthorhombic or tetragonal systems. Okay? Okay, so just to emphasize that. Okay, so now, this is interesting, because what it allows us to do is we can take what was a description that at least was moderately physical, but wrong, the Bragg equation, right, and try to now put this into a new mode of thinking. In real space, we talk about the incident electron beam coming down with some plane wave, right? We described it as K sub I, and we said that this thing's going to have a transmitted and a diffracted scattered wave, right? The transmitted wave is when the plane wave came into an atom and chose not to scatter off of it, right? And then there were some cases where we had coherent scatter, and we asked ourselves, you know, what directions are we going to see that yield constructive interference? And so the result is the wave comes in, we see a transmitted and a diffracted wave, and these diffracted waves have particular angles defined by Bragg's law, so that theta, right, and d have the relationship 2d sine theta equals n lambda, okay? So that's our real space description. And again, it's very visual, right? We have our crystal sitting in there. We take our crystal, we orient it appropriately so that we have an angle wherein it meets well with the lambda of our electron beam and yields diffraction events, okay? That's the idea that we have as we think about the sample scattering the wave on the way in. Okay. In reciprocal space, we know that we have an incident wave Ki. Ooh, wait, that's 1 over lambda, right? So we took, again, something that was a real space thing, a wavelength, right? And now it's equal to a 1 over lambda. Ah, reciprocal, okay? Okay, so there's Ki, which is our wave vector incident. We have, again, Kd, our scattered wave vector. And we found out in the previous lecture that we are going to have certain interrelationships between Ki and K sub d where the Bragg's law equation is met. And you'll remember those, right, that we had the difference between Kd and Ki equal to something called capital K, right? And that led us to show that it was equivalent to Bragg's law whenever we had the right theta Bragg, okay? Well, what we're going to do now is we're going to say that capital K, we're going to show that, right, whenever we have this thing equal to a vector G, the one that we just spent so much time describing and understanding, that's when diffraction is going to occur. Okay? Okay. You'll note I threw a G in last time, and I said, we'll talk about that later. Well, here we are. We're talking about it. Okay? Okay. So let's go back and look at Bragg's law and put this now in terms of these K sub I's and K sub D's and take advantage of the fact that this vector G that we've defined has these nice little meanings to it. Okay? Okay. So again, Bragg's law, the thing you will immediately spout upon being in your PhD exam qualifying exams, right? 2D sine theta equals n lambda, right? It's just go to that. Okay. All right. So the wave comes in, the wave hits an atom. It scatters off of that atom at particular angles defined by the Bragg angle, right? You're going to see constructive interference in the far field. Great. We went through and did this in the previous lecture, looking at K sub I, K sub D, right? Saying that the difference between K sub D and K sub I we can define by this capital K. And we have this angle between them equal to 2 theta whenever we have the constructive interference of Bragg's law. Okay. We also showed that the capital K had a length equal to 2 sine theta over lambda, and it has a length equal to n over d. Again, we did that last time. And again, I threw this up there last time, that this capital K equals some vector g. And I didn't tell you why I did that. Okay? Well, that's what we want to do now, is we want to look at this relationship. So again, the capital K, as we discussed last time, has a proportional relationship to 1 over lambda. It has a proportional relationship to 1 over d. So again, reciprocal, 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 that's where this all comes in. Okay, so we said that the Lowy equations have a solution whenever this vector, capital K, is equal to our special vector G, right? That's what we said when we derived the Lowy equations, that we have, whenever we have a integer times A star plus an integer times B star plus an integer times C star, we end up solving the Lowy equations. Okay, that's the definition of the Lowy equations. All right, and again, this vector G is a special one because we know it has certain truths to it. We know that it's perpendicular to the real space HKLs, and it has a length of 1 over D. We've also shown, right, that this capital K has this property, 2 sine theta b over lambda, that was the last lecture, and that g equals 1 over the d spacing of HKL. If you go through and show that if capital K equals g, take this 2 sine theta b over lambda and the 1 over d HKL, equate them, flip them around, and you have Bragg's law, right? 2d sine theta equals n lambda. We'll talk about the n later, all right? Okay? So, the Lowy equations and the Bragg equation are exactly the same phenomena. They're describing diffraction. The Lowy one's more correct because it's going to capture scatter off of the atom, right? But the Bragg's one's nice because you can think about it as being diffraction off of these arbitrary planes HKL. Okay? Okay. Lior. Well, so do we have real planes that are reflecting electrons? No. We have electrons that are coming in and scattering off of atoms, right, and leading to the same angular equivalence as defined by the Lowy equations, right? And again, with the Lowy equations, what we have is we have this ability to position these atoms in unit cells, right, and get out of that a diffraction equation that captures some information about the unit cell positions, okay? Okay. Now, that is the next thing we're going to do is talk about atoms in the unit cell and the like, and that gives us an even more full description of diffraction from a unit cell. But for now, we're just describing the real lattice, the reciprocal lattice, and the fact that the Lowy equations have these relationships between the two. Okay? Okay. Okay. So, looking again at this, let's look at the diagram on the right. Showing in real space a plane HKL that is oriented at the Bragg angle with respect to the incident wave vector KI. Okay? So again, if capital K equal to KD minus KI, and I'm sorry, I keep slipping the I's and the O's. So KD minus KI, if that equals a G, then we have the Bragg equation satisfied for, in fact, this plane in real space HKL. G, equal to capital K, is perpendicular to HKL. It has a length that's equal to 1 over the D spacing. Okay? Okay. So now what happens in your head is that you start to try to figure out ways of taking real planes and matching them with reciprocal space vectors, right, to relate the dots that you see in your diffraction pattern to real planes. And it will work. And here's how it works. We're going to take advantage of the fact that these things These vectors K sub I and K sub D have a length equal to 1 over lambda, right? That's their definition. Okay, they have a modulus 1 over lambda. Okay. And we're going to take advantage of that and see what happens. This is called the Ewald sphere construction. Not Ewald, Ewald. Okay? What we're going to do is we're going to pick in reciprocal space an origin, okay? Just pick a place, anywhere in reciprocal space. On reciprocal space, we're going to take our vector K sub I, and we're going to stick the tail of it on that origin, and we're going to describe a sphere, a three-dimensional sphere, right, that has an equal length of K sub I, okay, about an origin point. In reciprocal space, okay? All right. So if we do that, we have also the fact that K sub D is equal to 1 over lambda as well. And we're going to place that also on the origin in the same way we've been doing throughout, right? Saying KI, KD. And we're going to say that whenever we have this sphere that we've described equal to 1 over lambda in size, right? Whenever it goes through a point in reciprocal space that has a G vector connecting it to the origin, then we're going to have diffraction occur. Okay. All right. So here's an origin. We'll take K sub I. We'll put the tail on the origin. We'll pop this thing straight up, and we'll draw a sphere around it. I think I might have said earlier this in the opposite mode. I think I said tail when I meant head. So I apologize for that. Let's stop, go through this in one more time. So what we're going to do is we're going to take an origin vector, pardon me, an origin point in reciprocal space, somewhere arbitrary. We're going to take this vector k sub I equal to the incident wavelength, 1 over the incident wavelength, and we're just going to draw this thing upwards, okay? All right. This is, of course, the reason to draw it upwards is because in the electron microscope, right, the electrons come from the top and go down. Okay, so what we're going to do now is we're going to then have a new point at the origin of this vector k sub I. We're going to describe a radius of a sphere that's 1 over lambda. We're going to find that if we place k sub d's at this point, then because of the definition of the Lowy equations and how we've derived all this, whenever this sphere intersects one of these points that connects between the origin and a reciprocal lattice point, we're going to have diffraction occur, and we're going to have a spot appear in our diffraction pattern. Again, these things all follow from the definitions of K sub I and D. The fact that we've carefully gone through and described when Bragg diffraction occurs, it occurs when K sub D minus K sub I, right, is equal to, has an angle between them of 2 theta, right? And so what this allows us to do is it allows us to make a construction that is purely geometrical to understand diffraction. So this is the definition of all of this, but here's how it really looks. Here's how it really looks. If we have a 200 kV electron microscope, 1 over lambda is about 360 inverse nanometers, okay? If we consider the distance between planes, d spacings, they're about on the order of a couple of angstrom-ish, all right? And so what that leads to in the inverse is something on the order of 3 inverse nanometers, all right? Okay? So what this means is it means that if we take our reciprocal lattice points and we just place these things in space where each of these points is equal to equivalent to a real plane HKL, then we're going to find that diffraction occurs whenever this avolt sphere intersects with these points. Okay, let's go back. I want to go back and pull all this together now that you've seen it go from start to finish. So we have a real space unit cell, right, which has planes like 100, 010, 101, 001. When you go from real space to reciprocal space, these planes are described by points. Those points have relationships, right, defined by the reciprocal lattice vectors. They have interrelationships with real space, so that each plane in real space is described by a point in reciprocal space. Okay? So, if we take our real lattice, it can be described equivalently by a reciprocal lattice, and that reciprocal lattice has points that are origins, at some origin and have some distance with respect to A star, B star, and C star, and each of those points corresponds to a plane HKL. Okay? So we take our planes in real space, and we get from this mode of going from real space to reciprocal space an array of points, and each of those points has direct interrelationships with real space planes as described by the HKLs that we choose for the Miller indices of those planes. Okay? So as I sit on the microscope, I think like this. All right? I have my sample. My electron beams come down my sample, right? And my sample has atom positions. Those atom positions are described by a unit cell in real space. Okay? They also lead to an equivalent description in reciprocal space. And that reciprocal space description is one of an array of points, and each of those points represent atomic planes in real space, HKL. They have directions that are perpendicular to the HKLs, and they have distances equal to 1 over the HKLs. Okay? All right. So my crystal exists, it sits in my microscope, it's oriented with respect to my electron beam. When I change the orientation of my sample, my reciprocal cell, of course, goes right along with that, right? So if I have unit cells A, B, and C in real space, and I just rotate them, okay, this much and that much, then my reciprocal space unit cell does the same thing, right? If A and B and C were moved, then A star and B star and C star move too, because they maintain their definition, right, under the way we've constructed this reciprocal lattice. Okay, so now what happens is we take and we consider this reciprocal lattice array, where each of these little black points I'm showing represents real space planes HKL, right? So you're going to have for every HKL a point in reciprocal space. We are going to go through and pick one of these points, doesn't matter which one, and we're going to call that the origin, okay? From that origin, we are going to place our incident wave vector, we're going to place it upwards just because the electrons are coming down the column, and then we're going to draw a sphere that has radius, and that's again a three-dimensional sphere, so it's coming not only, it's not only cutting along the board, but also out of the board, and we're going to have this thing have a radius equal to 1 over lambda. And what we're going to find is that whenever this sphere intersects one of these points, then K sub I and K sub D have this interrelationship that was shown on the previous page here, right? And this interrelationship between K sub I and K sub D is one that means diffraction occurs, right? Okay? And so what this means is that as I think about using the microscope, everywhere I see a spot is where the avolt sphere has intersected a reciprocal lattice point. And thus, it's where the HKL planes associated with that point have met the Bragg condition. Okay? One sec. Okay. Skip that. So when we look at a diffraction pattern, we see a bunch of spots. And the reason that we see a bunch of spots is because there's a bunch of intersections between this avolt sphere and the reciprocal lattice points. So now this is as though I'm looking at a piece of film. The black dots are where I'm seeing intensity in my diffraction pattern, and they are arising from places where the avolt sphere is intersecting the reciprocal lattice points. Okay? So there's my point array. It's an equivalent description to the real space HKLs. And these guys come down, right? You start an origin, you draw the avolt sphere, and whenever the avolt sphere intersects these points, then necessarily the diffraction conditions have been met, and you will see a diffracted spot. Okay, question from Lior. So where we will go next is we are going to go through and return to this full wave equation that had that big K dot R thing in it, right? And we're going to go through now and ask ourselves, how do we take this description and that description and put them together so that we can calculate intensities? Because we can, okay? But this is all geometry. This is just simply telling me, do I or do I not have diffraction occurring, okay? So if we look at this here, right, so this one arbitrary point that I've chosen that has the arrowhead on it, oh, that's why I have a laser pointer, sorry, right, is the origin. Let's call this HKL 111, right? Let's pretend that this is the description of the HKL plane 111 in real space and how it has the proper interrelationship in reciprocal space, okay? And so what this means is because this thing intersects that point, then I have met the Bragg conditions for HKL plane in real space, and I see diffraction from the HKL plane in real space. Okay? Okay. Okay. These guys, further out, where the avolt sphere does not intersect, are not well oriented with respect to the incident beam to give me diffraction, right? The avolt sphere doesn't intersect them, which means that the difference between their diffracted wave KD and K sub I does not equal, right, this capital K that was required for us to have the Lowy equations met. Okay? Okay. Another thing is that this reciprocal lattice is not planar, it's three-dimensional. Just like our real unit cell, right? We have A, B, and C, and so A star and B star and C star are also three-dimensional. And so the reciprocal lattice extends out of the page, above that origin, and below that origin. It's a real three-dimensional array of points. And so not only can you have intersections along that bottom row that's coincident with our arbitrarily chosen origin, but you can have it with other rows as well. The zero-order Lowy zone is the one that contains the zero beam. There's a first-order Lowy zone, and these are called higher-order Lowy zones. And so again, when we get on the microscope and look, we see diffraction patterns that have this sort of a look. They'll capture a series of spots from the zero-order Lowy zone, and then as the thing curves up, it starts to intersect with the first-order Lowy zone, and then maybe even another ring out there from the second-order Lowy zone. And so again, what that means is it means that there's other sets of planes that have the right relationship between the incident wave and the scattered wave to lead to diffraction by the Lowy equations. And the avolt sphere construction is just simply showing us that very geometrically. Okay? Okay. The first time you hear the reciprocal lattice thing, it seems like a lot of strangeness. Okay? It does. It's a very strange concept. But it's very visual because, again, the way that we work on the microscope is we see a bunch of spots. Every time we see a spot, in our head we say, ah, the avolt sphere is intersecting that reciprocal lattice point. Well, that reciprocal lattice point has a real interrelationship with the real space plane HKL. So whenever I see a spot, the avolt sphere is intersecting that reciprocal lattice point, that means that HKL is well-oriented for diffraction. Okay? Okay. So it's actually pretty simple and geometrical once you do it. Okay. Go home and think about it. Yeah? Yes. No, not between the rings. It's between the spots. So the G vector would go from the... This is our arbitrarily chosen origin shown in green here, right? And so there is a G vector that connects it to this point in the reciprocal lattice. To this point in the reciprocal lattice, to this point. They're different G vectors, right? And each of these points corresponds to different combinations of HK and L, and thus different real planes HKL. And again, whenever we happen to have the avolt sphere intersect these points, we see the diffraction event occur. Okay? There's lots of Gs. There's lots of multiplicities of Gs, right? So if you have HKL, you know, you can have 2H, 1K, 1L. And that's another reciprocal lattice point and equivalent to another real HKL vector. Okay? Yes?
Your detector is a flat plane. Is that cutting the AWOL sphere?
So my detector for this event is not a flat plane. My detector for this event is the AVOLT sphere. The way that this construction is put together, the diffraction event occurs when the avolt sphere construction is met, when KI, KD have the right interrelationship so that the avolt sphere intersects these, you know, gives you these points, okay? The detector, that's down at the bottom. We just use the lenses to look at the back focal plane, which shows this all, okay? The avolt sphere is quite flat in electron microscopy, which is helpful because we see lots of spots. Okay, and then one final thing that I'll show today, and we'll go over this one last time, is that we have a little cheater on all of this, too, is I'm talking about points, and three-dimensionally points, of course, are infinitesimally small, right? You know, if you really consider this as a point. Well, there's some breadth. They get to relax a little bit, and along the length of the incident beam direction, there's a relaxation. It's called a reciprocal lattice rod. We'll describe this, why this is. This is called a shape factor effect. It turns out it's because our samples are thin and there's incomplete cancellation along the beam direction. Okay? So what this allows is it allows actually some slop in the A-volt sphere construction, so we see even more spots than we should if we were considering strictly points. We'll get into that. All right? But that's another reason why we see in our real patterns lots of spots. Jeremy?
The number of G-spots that you see is primarily
dependent on voltage. So the voltage in your microscope's fixed. It's dependent on how you orient the crystal. Right? So, again, we get on the microscope, we look at this, you've watched the orientation of your sample change, and different spots get bright. They're always in the same point. Sorry, I'm talking too long today. It's a hard one. Yeah, go, please, yeah. Sorry. But, you know, they're always, the HKLs are always the same interrelationships. The reciprocal lattice points are always the interrelationships. Now, what you find is the beam comes down, you see the spots, and as you tilt, they either come or go in terms of whether you see the intensity there. And thus, you've either oriented it so that that particular plane described by this incident vector is now on the A-volt sphere or not. Okay? Whew. Yeah. Okay. Very comfortable.